hello and welcome to another edition of Gaelic Sportscast, following friends and Gaelic sports action around the world. On tonight's programme, Gaelic Sportscast brings you part one of a two-part episode featuring an interview with Northern Ireland academic and former Antrim footballer, Mr. Paul Darby, about his recently published book, Gaelic Games, Nationalism, and the Irish Diaspora in the United States. Mr. Darby is a senior lecturer in the School of Sports Studies at the University of Ulster in Belfast, and has authored works on international sports issues along with numerous scholarly articles on sport. He recently turned his focus to looking at the history of Gaelic games in the United States, an often overlooked part of the life of Irish immigrants in America. This brilliantly researched book traces the history of Gaelic games from its earliest inception in America and follows its development right through to the turn of the new millennium. Gaelic Sportscast is now joined by Paul Darby over Skype from his home in Belfast. You're very welcome to the programme, Paul.
Thank you very much, Dennis.
What is your GAA background? I understand that you've played inter-county for Antrim, and what club are you involved with?
Well, my club at present is a club based in Glengormley called St. Enda's. We currently play in Division 3 in the Antrim League. But I suppose my involvement in the GAA stems back to my early schooling. I went to a Christian Brothers primary school and secondary school, and of course, if you've two arms and two legs and one length and you're anyway half decent at kicking or catching a ball, then you've no choice. You have to play Gaelic football. And I suppose from then I then got involved in club football, played for a local club in North Belfast called Pearson's, then moved to St. Enda's and was fortunate enough to play inter-county football at minor, under 21 and senior level for Antrim.
Now, you played Gaelic football in America. Could you tell us, when was that, and could you tell us about that, please?
Well, I had the opportunity to play in Boston for a club called Notre Dame in the summer of 2000. I suppose part of the reason for going to Boston in 2000 was not only to play Gaelic football, but also to do some research for my book. But obviously playing for a club was useful in terms of getting to understand the local Gaelic football scene, and it was also hugely enjoyable as well. We actually won an intermediate championship in Boston that year and went on to play in the final of the All-Americans, where we lost in the final.
Oh, wow, you did very well. So you had a successful season there in Boston.
Indeed, we did. Yeah. We had a good squad that year. A lot of the home base players were very strong, and of course we brought in a couple of sanctioned players who really strengthened the team. Mm-hmm.
So your book, Gaelic Games, Nationalism, and the Irish Diaspora in the United States, which came out, by the way, when did it come out again? Was it in October last?
It came out last September, although it's actually just been released in the States.
Okay. How did the idea for the book come about?
Well, I suppose the idea for the book really stemmed from my own personal involvement in Gaelic games, but also in my experiences as an Irish migrant myself, and somebody who played Gaelic sport outside the island of Ireland. I left the north of Ireland in 1997 to take up a lecture and post at Liverpool Hope University. I found that a difficult transition to make, not least, of course, because I thought at that stage that I was leaving behind a sort of career in Gaelic football. But within a couple of weeks of arriving in Liverpool, I got a call from a guy who was involved with the John Mitchell's Club based in Birmingham, and he very kindly invited me to come down and field for the team. It was a strange experience because, I mean, I was by the time I'd arrived down in Birmingham and you go through the gates of Portna Heron, it almost felt like I was coming home. You know, psychologically, it felt good. I was mixing with like-minded people. I was involved in playing Gaelic games again. So I suppose gradually I started to develop a research question around, well, what is the significance of Gaelic games for Irish immigrants around the world? I had a couple of students at the time from Ireland who were interested in similar questions, and they did undergraduate dissertations looking at the GA in Liverpool, the GA in London. And then I had the chance, as I said earlier, in the summer of 2000 to go and play some football in Boston. And I decided at that stage to combine my academic interest in sport with my playing involvement in Gaelic sport. So I suppose that's really where the idea stemmed from.
I understand too that you felt that Gaelic games in America was being left out of the equation, so to speak, when it came to talking about the Irish diaspora and the history of the Irish in America.
Yeah, completely. I mean, I find that somewhat surprising, given the significance of the GAA in the States, the fact that in the broader historiography of Irish America that there was virtually no mention of the GAA. There were a few sort of populist histories of the GAA that were written by some of the divisional boards. But they very much focused on facts and figures and who won championships and what years and you know, who the key players were. But I suppose I was interested in exploring the sort of the deeper significance of Gaelic games, its relationship with Irish identity, for example, and was also interested in exploring the history of Gaelic games. So I suppose in some senses, I was really starting from scratch because there had been virtually nothing written on the GAA, certainly in an academic sense.
Mm-hmm. And starting from scratch, how did you go about the enormous task of literally compiling a history of Gaelic games in America? You had to spend some time over there, yes?
Yeah, I mean, from the summer of 2000, right up until the summer of 2006, I would spend periods of between, I suppose, 2 or 3 weeks up to 3 months in various American cities, basically engaged in a number of sort of research field trips, if you like. And I suppose the starting point for doing that work, at least in terms of getting an understanding of the history of Gaelic games, was to use a range of archives that were held in public libraries. I used, for example, a lot of the early Irish American newspaper sources, such as the Gael, the Advocate, the Citizen. I was then able to get access to a number of specialist archives of the Irish in America, including archives held at Boston College, the American Irish Historical Society in New York. New York University also had a specialist Irish archive. The United Irish Cultural Center in San Francisco. So all of that helped me to kind of piece together the historical development of the GAA in each of the cities that I was looking at. In order to bring the story up to date, I was very reliant on the kindness and generosity of Gaels in the United States. And I spoke to numerous Gaels players, administrators, supporters, benefactors, and they gave me a lot of their time and a lot of crucial information that allowed me to bring the story of the GAA and the States up to the current day.
Undertaking the enormous task of covering the history of Gaelic games in America, you look at 4 cities, New York, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco. In the first chapter, you describe how the famine immigrants in the East Coast cities of New York, Boston, as well as Chicago and the Mid-Atlantic region, suffered discrimination at the hands of the nativist Yankees. But in San Francisco, things were different. Setting the scene for the arrival of Gaelic games leading up to the late 1800s, what was life like for the Irish immigrants in these cities?
Well, life for the Irish immigrant, and certainly along the northeastern seaboard of the United States and in the Midwest, much less so on the West Coast, was very difficult. Very often Irish immigrants lived in cramped, squalid conditions. In New York, they were based around the Five Points District in Lower Manhattan. In Boston, they were based, of course, in Southie and along the docks area. And conditions were very, very difficult. Of course, the Irish were also confronted with discrimination from the local Anglo-Saxon population, who viewed them with disdain, I suppose would be an accurate description. As far as these white Anglo-Saxon Protestants were concerned, the Irish were an unruly race. They had brought with them a religion that was detested in the United States at that time. And as a consequence, the Irish suffered a whole host of discrimination, particularly in terms of seeking employment opportunities. I mean, in the 1850s and 1860s, you see job advertisements in the local press. And at the bottom of those advertisements, you would see the letters N-I-N-A, which, of course, stood for No Irish Need Apply. Mm-hmm. So I suppose the lot for Irish immigrants in the 1860s, 1870s was difficult. Although gradually moving through from the 1870s into the 1880s, the Irish were sustained in many ways by a whole host of socioeconomic, benevolent, political, cultural organizations, including, of course, the GAA, that did a lot in terms of helping them to adjust to the conditions that they find themselves in the United States.
Trying to make the most of things over there, they were working hard every day, and they had like Sundays off, and they would, you know, a lot of these benevolent organizations like the Irish Hibernians and so forth, you know, they would have picnic days, and they would be kind of unregulated Gaelic games take place in hurling and football there, as well as athletics contests. What were the earliest references to Gaelic games being played in American cities that you found in your research?
Well, the earliest references to Gaelic games being played in the States that I came across certainly preceded the influx of famine immigrants in the 1850s. For example, there are accounts in the New York Gazette in the 1780s of quite rudimentary forms of hurling being played. In New York, you also see the establishment of the first club, which was called the Irish Hurling and Football Club, in 1857. In Boston, I suppose the first club there was the Irish Athletic Club of Boston that was founded in 1879. On the West Coast, one of the prominent newspapers there, Alta California, records in 1853 that a Gaelic football club was established there. So certainly from around the 1850s onwards, you see the emergence of clubs, formally constituted clubs, that begin to play unregulated, uncodified versions of Gaelic games.
And these events drew large crowds of Irish immigrants, and you point out that local newspapers helped to drive such events, such as the Gael in New York and the Pilot in Boston. Often the editors of these papers viewed a kind of the Gaelic games as a cultural revival, and something of the ethos of nationalism as well thrown in there, which I'm sure that a lot of the Hibernians and so forth would have supported as well. But John Boyle O'Reilly, who was instrumental, I believe, in helping the Gaelic games and athletics progress in New York, on page 37, you say that as well as seeking to provide recreational opportunities for working Irish immigrants, O'Reilly was clearly advocating participation in sports that were part of the broader cultural revival aimed at creating rallying points for Irish nationalism and separatist demands. It would appear that there was a lot of support for the Irish cause abroad.
Oh, absolutely, and people like John Boyle O'Reilly were absolutely instrumental in terms of promoting the nationalist cause in cities like Boston and further afield. I mean, John Boyle O'Reilly is a very interesting character. He was a former member of the IRB, the Irish Republican Brotherhood. And in the mid-1860s, he is engaged in attempting to convert members of the British Army to the Irish Republican cause. His activities were uncovered, and he was sentenced to 20 years in prison. He's then shipped off to a penal colony in Western Australia. He escapes a few years later and ends up in Boston. And shortly afterwards, he, of course, becomes the editor of the Boston Pilot, which is a prominent Irish Catholic weekly. So O'Reilly's credentials as a Republican, as a nationalist, are clear. Now, O'Reilly, like other nationalists of the time, recognised that in order to garner support for Irish separatist demands, there was a need to revive Irish cultural forms, and of course sport was one of the key components of that. So John Boyle O'Reilly very quickly got involved in the promotion of Gaelic games. In fact, he was one of the leading figures in Boston in terms of this movement to generate interest and enthusiasm in Gaelic games. And of course, given that he was editor of the Boston Pilot, Gaelic games received extensive coverage in that particular newspaper.
And how influential were the early Irish American athletics clubs in the organisation of Gaelic games in cities like New York, Boston, Chicago, and San Francisco as well? Did they play a major role in getting things organised?
Yeah, the Irish, various Irish athletic clubs, certainly in the Northeast Seaboard, were influential in terms of promoting Gaelic games. I mean, remember at that time the Gaelic Athletic Association back home in Ireland was not only oriented around the promotion of Gaelic football and hurling, it was also oriented around the promotion of athletics, and that situation was certainly replicated in the United States. And as I mentioned earlier, in Boston, for example, the first club as such that began to play Gaelic games on a regular basis was the Irish Athletic Club of Boston, which was founded in 1879. In New York as well, you see around the turn of the century, a number of Irish athletic clubs are also involved in terms of promoting Gaelic games. So quite clearly, athletic clubs, Irish athletic clubs in the States were significant.
So, toward the early part of that, latter part of that century, the mood was ripe, definitely, and for the seeds to be sown for the promotion of Gaelic games in these eastern cities, would you say?
Without a doubt. I mean, by the 1880s, the seeds, if you like, had been sown. And what you find happening moving into the late 1880s and early 1890s is you see the establishment of a number of clubs oriented specifically around Gaelic games. And of course, that development was aided by the inception of the GAA in Ireland in 1884. Alongside the establishment of clubs, of course, you also see the establishment of a number of quite fledgling governing bodies for Gaelic games in a number of cities across the states. For example, in 1888, you see the establishment of the San Francisco GAA. In 1891, you have the establishment of the GAA of Illinois. Then again, in 1903, in California, you see the establishment of a governing body. So these organizations, these governing bodies and the early clubs were absolutely instrumental in terms of the early promotion of Gaelic games in the States.
And so let's talk about that year of years, 1888, on the East Coast when what became known as the Irish Invasion. Could you tell us about that?
Now, the Irish Invasion was essentially a project that was hatched by Michael Cusack, who of course was the founding father of the GAA, and he enlisted the help of Michael Davitt and Maurice Davin, the legendary Irish athlete and of course first president of the GAA. And the idea behind the Gaelic Invasion was to attempt to raise revenue for for re-establishing the Talbian Games, which were an ancient Irish athletic and cultural festival. And Cusack, Davin and Davitt thought that a tour of Irish athletes to the United States would be an ideal way of generating that income. Of course, as part of the Irish invasion, the secondary aim, if you like, was the promotion of Gaelic games in the United States. Now, as it turned out, the tour wasn't overly successful in terms of raising the revenue required to revive the Talbian Games. Attendances, with the exception of Philadelphia and Boston, attendances at games and athletic meets were quite low. Of course, there were mitigating circumstances. There was inclement weather when the Irish athletes toured. It also coincided with the US presidential election, so there wasn't a lot of media coverage. So in terms of generating revenue, the tour wasn't particularly successful, but it was successful in terms of its secondary aim, which was to generate interest in Gaelic games in the States. And Gaelic games, certainly in Boston and New York, were aided by the fact that I think 17 or 18 of the touring party actually decided to stay in America and didn't travel home with the rest of the Irish athletes. And they really gave great impetus in terms of developing Gaelic games at that particular period.
Around that time, the 1880s, there was a different dynamic going on in San Francisco as regards the Irish immigrants as well there, living in the city. And
well, the experiences of the Irish in San Francisco were certainly distinct and different from the experiences of their counterparts in the northeastern seaboard. This was largely a consequence of the fact that most of those Irish who moved, or a lot of those Irish who moved to San Francisco and to California more generally, were already or had already immigrated to the States. You know, so they had experience of what it was like to live in a foreign land. They had become well adjusted to the rigors of being a migrant. And after the gold rush, a significant number of Irish immigrants traveled to San Francisco. Of course, one of the other big differences was the fact that you didn't really have a strongly entrenched Anglo-Saxon Protestant community in San Francisco. Catholicism was quite prominent in the city at the time. So Irish immigrants in San Francisco certainly didn't experience the same sort of discrimination that their counterparts experienced in the northeastern seaboard and certainly in the Midwest.
And how did that affect the development of Gaelic games in San Francisco?
It clearly had an impact, because the development of Gaelic games in San Francisco was a little bit slower than it had been across on the East Coast, and I think this was maybe a consequence of the fact that, you know, Irish communities didn't really feel under siege or threatened in any way. So as a consequence, they felt less reliant on the sorts of Irish organizations that had sustained their counterparts, their fellow countrymen on the eastern seaboard. Although that said, by the late 1880s, early 1890s, you do see the emergence of a reasonably strong GA in California and specifically in San Francisco.
Now, returning to New York, while everybody in Ireland knows about Gaelic Park in the Bronx as being the home away from home for Gaelic games enthusiasts in New York, there was an earlier mecca, if you will, for Gaelic games, and this one was in Queens, Celtic Park in Queens. Could you tell us about that and a little bit about the history of Celtic Park?
Celtic Park was acquired by, the lease for Celtic Park was acquired by two individuals, William Prendergast and Joseph Kennedy, who were significant and influential figures within the New York GA. And they acquired the lease in 1898. And between 1898 and 1925, when Celtic Park closed, it was really the primary centre for Gaelic games activity in New York. That's not to say that, of course, the organisation of Gaelic games at Celtic Park always ran smoothly. There were constant disputes in terms of access to the grounds, in terms of which clubs would get preferential treatment. I think the fact that the lease for Celtic Park wasn't actually held formally by the GAA, it was actually held by the Irish American Athletic Club, caused difficulties for the GAA, and that led to quite a lot of acrimony in the first decade of the 20th century.
We continue our conversation with Mr. Darby in part two tomorrow, when we look at the first Irish tours to America, some thorny issues between the New York GAA and Croke Park, and as well as talking about the significance of GAA stadia in America, such as Gaelic Park, and their importance for Irish immigrants in America. Music written by John McCartan and performed by John McCartan and Lunasa.